So this is the fourth talk in the series on self, non-self, and the world. And perhaps it can be titled, Who or What is in Control? And I remember a little piece from the book The Little Prince, where the little prince was standing in front of the king who was on the star, and the king said, I command you to stand up. And the little prince said, but I'm already standing. So the king said, well, that shows that I'm the king. I'm commanding everything to be what it is, so I'm the king of the universe. And the other little story I have is from Kirillov, Russian author, about a horse. And the horse was desperately trying to get out of the mud. It was stuck in the mud. It was pulling and pulling and heaving and sweating to get itself out of the mud. And eventually it managed to pull itself out of the mud with great effort. And then a fly that had been sitting on its tail flew up to the front of the horse and said, we did it. We really have illusions of control. And it keeps on. And we are very, very busy with control. And it's kind of heavy because we've somehow deeply defined through the survival mind, through the need and the pressure to survive once we're born into a body, we can't help seeing life as threatening, as chaotic, as unpredictable, as wild, and not that interested in us. And we're looking for defense. And the main defense we have to sort of hang on to is the me. I am the only thing. If I can do me right, then I can hold life there. I can be all right. Our self is basically a mechanism for defense and a mechanism with which we try and control the wild, unpredictable, uncontrollable life. And the trouble is we can't. But we not only do it with the me, we also do it with everything else. So our automatic habit to know things, objects. I need to know what this thing is. I have to know it. I have to define it. I have to know what it's used for, that it's not threatening, that it's useful, what other people think about it. I don't like to know chaos. I need to know. And the need to know is another defense. The need to define, the need to give labels, the need to describe, and the need to hold things out there as things. And any hint of no control can be quite threatening. And any hint of no self can be quite threatening, because it sort of shakes the ground. And many, many questions rise up, which some of us are asking here. If there is no self, which we don't need to ask that question because it's not a really useful question. If is not relevant here, but it's a question that comes up. If there is no self, how do I act? How do I decide? How do I choose? Where do I go? How do I get up in the morning? What's meaningful in life? What's the point? So we have a sense that if without a self, everything collapses. and I'm kind of a lost kind of molecule in the universe floating about. And we really don't want to know that we're not in control. We don't want to see it. There's a virus that got into me, which is where all this symptoms come from, that I'm suffering from. The virus, the result, the symptoms, the mucus, the coughing, the story goes around. It's nothing to do with me. I didn't invite the virus. It's not my virus. The body didn't ask me. The body, I'm not in charge of what the body does with it. The whole thing is nothing to do with me. But it's come and it's grown and it's so on. And it's, we don't like that. We don't want to know about it. So the Dharma has a radical shift in the point of view. The radical shift is called immaculate, pure. The Dharma, the Buddha described the Dharma as a pure vision, meaning without illusion and without contamination, stains. And it's basically, the Dharma is basically a non-dual vision of reality. The Dharma is basically telling us, just really look carefully, how can there be two sides to an experience? Subject, object. Can there be two sides? The observer and the observed. Two things. Or not. Which side do we look at things from? That side or this side? And the Dharma says, wait a minute, there isn't two sides to an experience. We are made of the world. The world is made of us. The world is looking out of our eyes. We and the world are one thing. It cannot be anything else. The truth is that there isn't anything other than connection. And that when we cut the world into pieces, we are constructing a painful illusion, which we all need it and we all do it. We can't help it. And that really is so radical. Few people can really, really feel okay with it. It's threatening, it's shaking. Fair enough. It's because we've invested so much in a different way of looking, in the looking of the world as subject, object, differences, definitions. It's just a habit, though. Everyone will see this differently. Actually, it's just a habit. We have a habit. This is a bowl. You ask my dog what my dog would think about this. He would look in there and go, where's the dog food? I know what this is. This is a dog food container. No, it's a Tibetan bell. It's really special. When we really see things as they are, there is no definition, label, or thingness about them. There is no things there. Things meaning fixed objects or fixed self. The world isn't made of fixed things. And the Dharma really invites us to look and to look again and to look again and to look again. Okay, you can call it deconstruction, you can call it awareness, you can call it many, many things. But look again. The whole origin of Zen, according to the Zen tradition, is when the Buddha, in answer to a question about reality, he just picked up a flower and he held it in front in his hand and was utterly silent. Basically, what is this? And any word I say about it is illusion, doesn't work. Is the flower in the mind? Is the flower in the world? Does the mind land on the flower, go out to the flower and make a flower? The consciousness jumps out and says, flower. Is the flower in its shape? Where is the flower? In the flowerness of it. What is the flowerness of it? So the flower is a convention, is an agreement. Okay, it's helpful agreement. We need to have some sort of agreement. We need to have some sort of convention. It's helpful, otherwise we can't cross the road. If we don't know what a bus is, then it will knock us down. If we don't know what food is, we'll never go to the dining room and eat anything. We just won't recognize the difference between food and stones. Of course we need, as a convention, we need to know. But we don't need to give these things of the world the ultimate truth. They're not ultimately true. So we need to challenge these assumptions with which we look at the world. If we want to go deeper into reality, and if we want to undo the pain of pressure all our life to control the world, there's pain in that. There's struggle in that. And if we're ready to challenge that, we have a job to do, which is to really look carefully and see what things are, and see that things are not like that. So, fortunately, happily, it's not another illusion that when we look carefully at things, they actually show us themselves. So we look carefully at a flower, the flower will tell us, I'm not really a thing. Never mind what you think about me, and what you've read about me, and how many flower pictures you looked at when you were a child, I'm not really what you think. I'm made of much more. The breath, when we look at it, will say, I'm not really a breath. I'm made of so many things. I'm made of so many parts. I'm changing all the time. I'm a whole universe in one breath. So don't call me a breath. When looked at carefully, we must slowly and steadily, it won't happen in 1 minute, because we've put so much energy and time and 20 years in school and into creating a world like that, that looks like that. Things and me and the world and duality and two sides to an experience and subject, object, etc. We've put so much into it. But when we do take the time, energy, intention, mind, consciousness, awareness, and wisdom, we will begin, instead of seeing a world of things, we will see a world of relationships. The world will appear to us as nothing but relationships. Duality collapses when looked at closely. It can't stand a deep gaze. And the same for us. This self can't stand a deep gaze. As soon as we really begin to gaze, to look, to explore the self, it can't stand anymore as a thing, because it's an assumption. It's a belief. So what I said the other day, one of the four attachments is belief in a self. It's a belief. Again, don't want to make confusion here. It's a belief we need in order to cross the road. It's a belief we need in order to grow up. We can't grow up healthy if we don't have this belief in an organizing principle that is, in a way, running the show. Otherwise, as I say, we won't be able to cross the road. So it's a belief that we need, but we don't need to hang on to it all our life, to hold it in front of us, not to question it, and not to look through it. Because when we look at the self carefully enough, it's transparent. We see through it. It's no longer a thing. And there's many traditions, spiritual traditions in the world that look directly at the self, like Ramana Maharshi, the Advaita, a sort of new Advaita. Ramana Maharshi, as many of you know, was just offering basically one practice, which is to keep constantly asking, who am I? And it's not only Ramana Maharshi, there are Zen monasteries, you go there, and they just say, okay, sit down and ask, who am I? And ask non-stop. And when you've got one answer, keep going. When you've got another answer, keep going. No answer will work. No answer will be an answer. You just have to keep going and keep going and keep going and keep going. So every possible answer you come up with is in the end not it. And in the end, the one asking, who am I, kind of it goes back on itself and undoes itself. The asker, in the end, sort of disintegrates, destroys itself, undoes itself. Ramana Maharshi's image for that is that a stick that's stirring a fire. So you stir a fire to keep it going, or you use a stick to make sure that the fire keeps burning, that the sticks there will burn. And in the end, the fire burns the stick itself, the one you use to stir the fire. So in the end, the question burns you. You asking the question, no answer works, and in the end, the asker is also burnt up in the fire. So, the truth is that, thankfully, we do know a little bit of this. We do know this. It's not something weird and strange that, well, I'm okay, why do I need all this? Well, my life is okay, I go to work, I go home, I have a family, I eat, I sleep, I have some money in the bank. Do I need any of this? It seems like hard work, and why do I have to deconstruct things? But there is a little voice in us that knows the truth. And that voice will not leave us alone. Because we can live in illusion 90% of the time, but 100% of the time living in illusion, we get restless, we get uncomfortable, we suffer from things that we don't know why. Things happen. Usually life comes with its uncontrollable, unpredictable changes. And I was all right, everything was fine. I had a job and I had this and I had this. Why did life come and do this to me? Like the story of Job in the Bible. He was a good man, he was great, he was fine. And along came a kind of conspiracy of the devil and God to say, you think you're fine? I want to show you one, two things. there will be voices in us that say, wait a minute, this is not it. And thankfully, those voices exist. I sometimes laugh because some people say, when people say, oh, I'm so busy at work and I'm so busy in my high-tech company and I have no time, working 12 hours a day, I need to come back to myself. Okay, so where do you go to go back to yourself? Well, I go to the sea, or I go to the forest, or I go to a retreat. And where's the, what's self about the sea? Oh, no self there. There's no self in the forest. And so coming back to yourself is really coming back to no self, or less self. we it's not, if I say, you know, where do you go to come back to yourself? More time in the office. But indeed, I do want to address this question, and I will address it more in other talks, the fear that we have, that if I have less selfing, I won't know how to act and survive in the world. That I need this self to operate as an operating system and to run the show, and I need a really good, strong self. Otherwise, where's my will? Where's my direction? And where's my choices? Who will choose if there's not if there's less me in there? How will I know? How will I navigate through life? How will I make decisions? How will I succeed? And I think the problem here is, again, we're not looking carefully enough. It's, again, a quick kind of instant view, which we're not looking deeply enough at this question. Because, of course, there will be action. Of course, we will do what we need to do in life. There's absolutely no chance that anyone that is kind of has non-dual awareness or opening their horizons will sit at home like a kind of porridge and do nothing, turn into a jelly. We act. Life is action. We will be part of life. The question is how. And so if we look carefully at how we decide things, if we look carefully how you and I actually decide, we might see that we don't actually decide things because of this self. This self isn't always in charge of decisions. The self is often a very bad decider, because what the self does is saying, what's better for me? What's less better? What's better for me? What's not so good for me? Is this better? Is this not better? You know, we've all been through that. Months and months of indecisions, of uncertainties, of confusions and of depression in order to know, if I do this, then. That's the self trying to work out the best track. If, then. Shall I get married? Shall I not get married? Shall I go here? Shall I go there? The self is not a good source for action. So what's a good source for action? Coming from a bigger place of awareness. What's fitting and right in this moment? What action fits right? What action is harmony? What action is compassionate? What action is needed by the world, by others? That's not the self will tell you the answers. It's much more in the consciousness, in the awareness, in the heart, in the tummy, in the intuition. It's not the self that has those answers. It's a sense, it's in the relationship we have with the world. If we have a relationship with the world, we see the world, and the world sees us, we'll know what to do. Our decisions and choices coming from another place, not from me and what is best for me, which is the only voice really that the self knows. So we'll see, we will act, and the act will come from a deeper place, a sense of rightness, a sense of connectedness, and from there we act. And much, much quicker and easier. We know exactly. I'm going there. It just, why? It's right. It's the right thing to do. I'm there. Instant. Not 6 months of headache. And in a way, all our problems can really be helped by an awareness that is not locked in to selfing. And if we think of any of the issues that trouble us, it doesn't matter what, issues of loneliness, issues of struggle, of sadness, issues of meaning. We feel life doesn't have the meaning. All of the answers here, or the inspiration, or the windows to these problems, they're not coming from more selfing. More selfing does not solve them. Less selfing might. We often feel confused. And then we feel, I need to know who I am in order to know what to do. I need to know who I am. The sense of confusion that we might have. It's very human. It's really okay. But very often, if we're confused and kind of lost in the forest, it's not more self that will save us. As in the poem called Lost, it's knowing what the tree is, and knowing another tree, and the tree's all right, and the bird up there is fine, and the bird is telling us you're not lost, and the tree is telling us you're not lost, and the earth is telling us you're not lost, and our breath is telling us you're not lost, and our tummy is telling us you're not lost. So it's not the self that's telling us the answers. It's our relationship with. It's our out of self. The sense of relationship. The sense of connectedness. The sense of listening to life. And letting life call us. And tell us what to do. And give us clarity. We're actually, if we have less controlling self, we're going to hear loads more voices that we really want to hear. The sense of being inside a kind of a self perspective, a subject, actually shuts down so many voices which we don't listen to because we're sort of busy with my view and my interests and my directions and my support and my needs and we just don't listen to all the sorts of subtle voices that are right there telling us things from inside our body-mind, from outside. And we kind of, they're a bit thin, these voices. We don't listen to them. But the minute we kind of quieten the big shout called me, then all the other voices begin to be heard. Because the me sort of drowns them out. It's the biggest instrument in the orchestra. So it's important to look at this movement in deconstructing the self and kind of get rid of the word no or the word non. It's much more a word yes. When we actually reduce the control of self, there is a huge opening. What happens is an opening. We are less behind a filter or walls, and we begin to feel that the world and us are in intimate relationship. We are becoming absorbed into the world. We are becoming merged into the world. We are becoming flowing with the world. The world and us dance together, which we couldn't do before because we were looking at the world through the kind of glasses of me and what I want from the world and what I have to protect myself and what I have to keep away and what I have to control. The minute we kind of reduce that, take off those glasses, then we find openings . The non-dual teaching is very powerful, very, very powerful non-dual teaching, both of the, of course, of the Buddha and also of Advaita. And Advaita will go right there, straight away, to the non-dual teaching as this is it, like in the title of Nisargadatta Maharaj's book. That's it. Just go there. No duality, no subject object, totality. There it is. When Nisargadatta Maharaj went to his teacher Maheshwar, and he really didn't get any teaching. He didn't get all these Dhamma talks and retreats and practices and so on. He went to his teacher and his teacher said to him, "You are the absolute. Now go away and work that one out." And then his teacher died. He had no one to ask. But he spent basically 4 years doing nothing else. And then he was there. And he lived his hugely inspiring. He lived in the ultimate. I mean, he saw everything through that view or reality, ultimate reality. And Advaita teachers are a huge inspiration. I've been inspired by Krishnamurti for donkey's years. And Krishnamurti said, look, it is the truth. The non-duality is the truth. You must get there if you ask the questions the right way. If you keep looking, you will get there. You will see it because subject, object are not in reality. So if you keep inquiring, Krishnamurti was so insistent, inquire, look, don't stop, don't get second-hand conclusions, second-hand answers, quick answers, summaries, assumptions. Cut through, keep cutting through, ask the question, and you will get there. Krishnamurti said a beautiful thing among many, I mean, millions of words, but one beautiful thing that I remember about this. He said, the whole tragedy of human existence lies between the subject and the object. Total knockout. The non-dual teachers teach in a different way, though. They teach generally through words and satsang. They're often not encouraging meditation. But if you check out their lives, they've done a whole lot of meditation. And don't know any non-dual teacher that hasn't spent years and years and years sitting, lying in contemplation. Nisargadatta Maharaj, Papaji, everybody. So it's not the problem of meditation, it's the problem of any formal method. But in the Dharma, there's plenty of non-dual. And there's plenty of... Advaita means non-duality. Advaita, non-dual. But in the Dharma, of course, the Buddha was a great non-dual teacher, but he also taught method, as we're practicing here. But he didn't just teach method, he also taught non-duality. And in many strains of Dharma, of Buddhist teaching, like Zen and Dzogchen, are going very similar to Advaita, right there, to non-duality. Cut through you and the world, duality, its illusion. Jump from high, straight to the top of the mountain. Don't climb any mountains. Parachute down from the top onto the top of the mountain, straight away. But in the Dharma, usually the non-dual teachings tend to be available only for advanced practitioners. That tends to be the, and not to beginners. And I think there's some, there is some reason for that. And it's just that it's a big subject and I can't go into it now. But there is a risk that if you look at ultimacy, the ultimate, the oneness, the totality, as something which is told to you, or you need to believe in, or you kind of hold as something, you are still looking at it through the eyes of a self. And so there's a self looking at ultimacy, and that's often not clear and not worked with. Whereas the Dharma would say, work on the self. Ultimacy will appear. Don't think about ultimacy. Don't think about the absolute. Don't think about the God world. Don't think about, and don't forget, all this Buddhist emphasis, and of the Buddha himself, on Atma, on non-Atman, Atman and an-Atman, non-Atman, is really in response to a confusion around self, in which many spiritual teachers of the time until today will say the self is the universe and you are the universe. And it's not wrong, but it's so easily misunderstood. It's so easy to take that in the wrong way. And the Buddha said, okay, you don't need to go there. And the Buddha was really careful about the use of language. He would say, there is no reason to say, I am all. I am the universe. Leave that language, it's just confusion. Instead of that, the Buddha said, go back to basics, ask why you feel life is limited. What is it that you suffer? Where is your suffering? Undo the attachment that is the source. And in this way, the ultimate will express itself. You couldn't see it before because you were covered in self. As the minute you can dissolve this duality of self and world and the fixations and the stuckness and the issues, your suffering will go, as well as the sense of being an isolated self. Infinity will just appear when you don't stop it or obscure it. And so really the magic of the Dharma, the beauty of the Dharma, is that the whole thing, if you look carefully at this timeless moment right now, then duality collapses. It can't do anything else. If you look carefully enough at this moment right now, duality will collapse. It's not in the truth of things. You just need to look carefully enough. The observer and the observed just become a moment of observation, a moment of awareness. Where is observer? Where is observed? Where is a self? Where is a thing? Where is an object? Where? Do they exist? Do they need to exist? No, it's just a moment of being, a moment which is timeless, of presence, of being, of life, without end, without limits, without boxes, without dualities, without me and other. And that is the end, in a way, the end of suffering. There is a perfection in that, because all the suffering comes from this pressure to control and pressure to label and pressure to define and pressure to get things right and pressure to get things better. Without that pressure, slowly, you know, things are revealed as perfect. Life can't be imperfect. Now, God didn't make mistakes. Life is not imperfect. We can see life as imperfect, but life itself can't be imperfect. In the Dzogchen, it's called the natural great perfection. Natural. It's natural. It's not artificial. Just because you're doing some artificial Buddhist practice. Natural great perfection. And so in a way, we need to keep seeing, we need to keep close and intimate into this moment and sort of rest there and feel ourselves part of this world. Let go into the world, and it will invite us. It will hold us. We just have to let go into the world, and it will hold us. It will support us, and we can rest right there. Thank you.